This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Good evening, and welcome to the fall quarter 2006 continuing studies at Stanford University. This course is Religious Studies number 15, The Historical Jesus. My name is Tom Sheehan. I teach in the Religious Studies department, and I've spent many years teaching philosophy before coming to Stanford. What we'll do is have a 50-minute lecture, a break for 10 minutes, and then another 50 minutes of lecture and discussion afterwards. The problem with the topic that we're addressing is that it's too familiar. Usually you come to a college course because you don't understand something, you don't know what the topic is about, but when it comes to Jesus, I think everyone knows who he is. Everyone knows who Christ is. If you go on television, if you go on talk radio, if you just tune into the History Channel, everybody seems to have a story about Jesus. There are books called American Jesus by Stephen Prothero and Jesus in America by Richard Fox, both of them lectured here at Stanford, and you can tune into that on the Aurora Continuing Studies website, by the way. And not only are the media filled with stories about Jesus, but our whole social order in the United States is so strongly suffused with knowledge about Jesus. As contrasted with Great Britain, where only about 6% of the population practices their religion, of which 6%, the vast majority, are Muslims, by the way. By contrast, in the United States, 35% to 40% of Americans are evangelicals, born-again Christians, not to mention the mainstream Christians with their stories about Jesus. Among all of those, there are 34 million Baptists, for example, 14 million Methodists, of whom 72% think that non-Christians must convert to Christianity or else go to hell. Karen Armstrong, the religious writer, has pointed out that hell was invented by people who were very sure they were not going there, that someone else was. And they would probably be very upset if they got to heaven and found out that all those other people were let in. So we have to have a place for the others. And as I say, 72% of born-agains think that either we have to convert to Christianity or we'll burn. So not only the media, not only the social order, but even in the United States, somewhat uniquely, the political order is suffused with knowledge about understanding of Jesus. President George W. Bush, who is a Methodist, says that his favorite philosopher is Jesus Christ. And he's not alone. The former Attorney General, the Speaker of the House Majority Leader, are all evangelicals or born-again Christians. This is really American exceptionalism vis-a-vis the rest of the European North American world. Not just media, social, and political orders, but the economic order. Christian retailing, something you may want to consider, is a $4 billion a year business in the United States. A lot has been written on the fact that Christian books, tapes, and movies are a sort of a subculture that most Stanford people don't know about, but it certainly has a lot more impact than you would think. So everyone seems to know what Jesus would do or what Jesus said. And if you have any doubts about what he said, you just have to pick up a traditional Bible, turn to the New Testament, and my goodness, every word of his is in red. So we actually have his words. No doubt, therefore, about what Jesus said and did, and but no doubt about what he would say and do today. And if there is doubt, then we've got the institutionalized form of Jesus information, which are the Christian churches. In other words, there's a lot of social knowledge and a lot of personal investment built around Jesus. The meanings of people's lives, for better or worse, are influenced by what Jesus said or did, or what people say or do in his name. Many of us in this room are believers in Jesus as the Son of God. Many of us have suffered because that belief has led to persecutions of ourselves or our ancestors. But in any case, I think it's clear that in the United States, we are entirely socialized one way or the other with an introjected understanding of who Jesus of Nazareth was. But there are problems. So my second point would be, even though we've got this body of knowledge that we all seem to draw upon, that we exchange with each other, where announcers will get up on television and refer to Christ did this or that, right? They seem therefore to know what's going on. The problems with that are numerous. To begin with, his name wasn't Christ. I have a first name and a last name, you have a first name and a last name, and presumably he did, right? Jesus Christ. And any of his children would be called Mr. or Ms. Christ. He's usually called just by the name Christ, as if that was what he was known as during his lifetime. We have a comparable situation in Buddhism. We refer to the Buddha. Buddha did this, Buddha did that, but that wasn't his name either. His name was Siddhartha Gautama. And only certain people think he is the Buddha, where the word Buddha, a past participle in Sanskrit, means awakened, enlightened, enlightened. But somehow those titles get transferred to the man Jesus. But let's not call him Christ in this class, unless you're making a faith testimony, which we don't do in this class. Because Christ is a predicate, a title, that doesn't fit tightly with Jesus of Nazareth. It only fits if you're a believer in Jesus as the Christ. Second problem, his name wasn't even Jesus. If his mother had gone out into the piazza at 6 o'clock and said, Jesus, the pasta's ready, no answer, because she didn't speak English or Greek, Jesus. His actual name was Yeshua, which is an Aramaic being a certain almost separate language or dialect of Hebrew. Yeshua means Joshua. Right? In modern Hebrew, he's called Yeshu. But we'll refer to him, if you don't mind, from now on, as Yeshua. By just having to pronounce his name differently and in the way it was more, we think it was pronounced in his time, maybe we will sort of stop and put aside the usual understandings that we have about Yeshua. As soon as we say Jesus, as soon as we say Christ, we get into a discourse, we get into a paradigm that goes unquestioned. Then our whole purpose in this course is to question the usual paradigms about Jesus or Jesus as the Christ. And when we say Jesus, with that title after it, why don't we put in the word the, Jesus the Christ? Because there were a lot of Christs around in his time, significant people. For example, in about 135, a rabbi recognized a certain revolutionary as the Mashiach, that is to say, the Christ. We would translate that into Greek, Christos. So Jesus wasn't the only Christ, either expected or arrived. It all depends on who's making the connection. So if you wouldn't mind, we'll say Yeshua the Mashiach or Yeshua the Christ, something that'll jar our usual way of dealing with this. Well, his name wasn't Christ. It wasn't even Jesus. And the sources that we have, the primary sources that we have about him are very problematic. In the New Testament, or the Christian scriptures, if you prefer to call it, I think Old Testament, New Testament are prejudicial terms. They take a position on which of these covenants is passé, supposedly, or older. No, let's just say the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures. The Christian scriptures take up very little of the full Bible, right? In the Christian scriptures, there are four gospels. We call them canonical with one N because they were ruled in by certain political bodies of bishops as the accepted gospels about Yeshua. And canonical means ruled in. They're part of the canon. But there are lots of gospels that didn't get ruled in, that were considered for one reason or another unacceptable, too heretical, too crazy. The Gospel of Thomas, for example, parts of which go back to the first century of the Common Era, so they're contemporaneous with the canonical gospels, that one was ruled out because it ended up in the hands of some Egyptian Gnostics. So that one was ruled out. They ruled in crazy texts, like someone would call them crazy, like the Book of Revelation with all of its devastating crash and burn of the end of the world. Right? Although some churches didn't accept the Book of Revelation as canonical scripture. So who's making the decision about which sources are okay to read and which are not? there's been an explosion in antique scholarship about the first three or four centuries of the Common Era, because of a discovery of texts, the Nag Hammadi texts in the Egyptian desert. They were papyruses that were well preserved in the sand. They were in the sand because they were buried by monastic communities who were told that those texts were unacceptable. So it's a treasure trove to find those allegedly unacceptable texts, including the Gospel of Thomas. So who gets to say what are the legitimate sources about Yeshua? Who puts the words in red, we might say? Not only is there disagreement about which sources count, but if you take just the four canonical Gospels, they divide into three and one. Three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are very common in their orientation, in their historical story, so they're called synoptic Gospels. They can be seen together, syn together, optic seen. So the synoptic Gospels plus the Gospel of John, which is written at the end of the first century, the Common Era, if you try to harmonize the stories told there, the miracles performed, the words of Yeshua, you run into immense problems. This book that I'm holding up is called A Synopsis of the Four Gospels. What if we tried to look at them in columns, one next to the other, telling the same story? What would we come up with? The answer is chaos, because they don't tell the same story. These four gospel writers, whose names we don't know, the church is the one who added the names Mark and Matthew and Luke and John. We don't know the names of those authors. They were not emailing each other. They were not in contact. Matthew and Luke had read Mark. It's not clear what John had read. Right? We're using these names to designate the authors, even though we don't know their real names. Right? They were not conversant with each other's work to the detail that we would perhaps think popularly that they tried to get it right. Each one of them represented a community of believers that was also not in touch with that other community of believers, the more Jewish-oriented believers of Matthew's church, as contrasted with the Roman and Gentile-oriented believers of Luke and Mark's Gospels, for example. Therefore, they were expressing the opinions, evaluations, and theologies of these distinct communities, and they weren't trying to harmonize it. When evangelicals like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, or even mainstream priests and bishops, try to harmonize the gospel, they come up with cacophony. Therefore, we not only have questions about which sources are acceptable, but when we stick with what the official churches call the acceptable sources, we've got problems. And not just on minor points did Jesus use which or that in that sentence. We're talking major points. There are four canonical Gospels. I'll draw them up here on the board as boxes. As I say, these three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, 70 AD, 85 AD, as contrasted with John, written by about 100 AD. Let's take some major points. How many of them record Jesus' dramatic ascension into heaven at the end of time? Not a word about that in Mark. Not a word about that in Matthew. Matthew ends with the picture that's in front of the memorial church in the main quad of Jesus talking to a group of people and then saying, I am with you till the end of time, and then the words, the end, come up on the screen. He doesn't leave the earth. In John's gospel, he doesn't leave the earth. Only in Luke's gospel do you have the dramatic ascension of Jesus into heaven. The only problem is that Luke also wrote another text called the Acts of the Apostles, which begins with the ascension of Jesus into heaven. So he wrote both of these texts, and he gave two different dates for the ascension. This ascension at the end of the gospel takes place on the night that Jesus was resurrected from the dead, April 9th, 30 CE. This takes place 40 days later in the month of May, the 19th or 20th of May. Does it matter? And why didn't the others say, gee, I missed that when I was, visiting my mother-in-law that time. I better put it in my gospel to, make it correlate with the other. They didn't even care about that. So you have certain, quote-unquote, events in the popular imagination about what Jesus did that don't even appear in the vast majority of the canonical Gospels. There are other questions that we'll talk about in the second hour of our meeting about major issues, resurrection, birth, conception, etc., that the Gospels have radical disagreements on, major theological disagreements on, and they cannot be easily or at all harmonized. So this raises the question about these sources, even if we stick with the canonical ones. Were they attempting to say what Jesus said and did? Are they straightforward histories? Or are they rather theologized and mythologized histories? Sacred stories that cannot be checked out, do not check out, as historical events in the life of a Jewish peasant preacher in the first century. I'm talking now in this second paragraph, if you will, about all the problems that shake our idea that we have a solid, socialized understanding of what Jesus said and did. What about the popular mythologies about Jesus? We all know that Jesus went to India after he pretended to die. And if you don't know that, then you should read, I just have photocopies, but they are in the library, Jesus Died in Kashmir. Jesus Lived in India. They even have a picture of his tomb. This great Russian explorer named Nicholas Notovich, The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ. He tracks him down through India to Tibet. Let's see. Here's a direct descendant of Yeshua of Nazareth. Excuse me while I read his name here. This is from the book Jesus Died in Kashmir by A. Faber-Kaiser. His name, it says underneath, Jesus' living descendant, Zahi Bazdad Basarat Salim, who is a poet and whose father was a celebrated healer. Let's see, someplace else in here we have the death, a picture of Jesus' tomb that you can look at, and it's not in Jerusalem. You may also want to read Robert Price's article, Jesus in Tibet, a Modern Myth. But nonetheless, there are people who do hold to those non-canonical understandings of Yeshua. What about Mel Gibson's Passion? Is there anyone who didn't see the Passion of the Christ? Oh, you fortunate ones, you. These are the ones who didn't see it, right? Because he proclaimed, there's a nice article a couple of years ago in the New Yorker, February 25th, he claimed that he wanted to make a gospel that was really raw, hard history, so we'd see how much the man suffered. But as a matter of fact, he based his movie not on the gospel accounts at all of the four gospels. Instead, he went to the revelations that were given to, let me see if I can get her name here, Mother Mary Catherine Emmerich, who was a German nun and seer. Right, she had visions. She died in 1828, I believe it is. So Mel Gibson, on the one hand, saying this is real raw history, you'll see how bad it was, is actually drawing on mythology. And he's not much different from a lot of preachers and priests from the pulpit who wind in a little bit of Celtic mythologies with Jesus as they preach what people take to be historical truth about the prophet Yeshua. Or more recently, I should ask, how many of you didn't see the Da Vinci Code? The more of you saw Da Vinci Code, more of you got there. And there, as you realize, Yeshua had a sexual relationship with Mary Magdalene. Thereby, he died, of course, but she went on to France and gave birth to, I guess, a daughter, who eventually was the origin of the Merovingian. You know the story. I don't have to tell you the story. But you don't even have to go to Paris. You know how many people are spending $3,000 to go on the Da Vinci Code tour? All you have to go to is, let's see if I get the address right. It's 3437 Alma Road here in Palo Alto. And there you will have the Church of Gnosis, then they give the Latin title Ecclesia Gnostica, heirs to the Mary Magdalene line of apostolic succession, a church that's run by a Gnostic woman bishop, Rosamond Miller. I have her phone number, and you can go on the site and see if you put in www.gnosticsanctuary.org. Spell it correctly, run it together. You'll find out about Bishop Rosamond Miller's church, and she is by her own declaration, a physical descendant of Mary Magdalene, and therefore of Jesus of Nazareth, so we could touch and be in touch with them. There's lots of popular mythologies, and sometimes, not only in the popular imagination, but in the minds of preachers themselves, you know, the people who are supposed to be the teachers of the Christian communities, those things get blurred. Not to mention further problems, right? All the social, political, and ideological positions that are taken in Yeshua's name, as if we knew exactly what he would do and say about topics that he never declared himself on. Topics like smoking, drinking. Actually, he did declare himself on drinking. He was famous for drinking a lot of wine, and people criticized him for that. Communism, dancing, gay men and women. He never said a word about these. But preachers seem to be quite sure what he would have said if he'd had an opportunity to say it. There's that bad story about why fundamentalists cannot have, excuse me for mentioning this, sex standing up, because it could lead to dancing. And we know what Jesus would say about dancing. So. Perhaps we should hear the vox populi, the voice of the people speaking. Back in 1966, when we were all a lot younger, if we were alive even at that time, in March of 1966, John Lennon gave an off-the-cuff interview to a friend of his, Maureen Cleave, and it got published in the London Evening Standard. And he said, quote, but you'd have to hear John Lennon's Liverpool accent to really get it, "Christianity will go, it'll vanish and shrink. I don't know what'll go first, rock and roll or Christianity. We," meaning the Beatles, "we're more popular than Jesus now." That was the quotation that got him in trouble with Western Christians. It was sort of like saying something about the Prophet Muhammad. "We're more popular than Jesus now." Jesus was all right, but his disciples were thick and ordinary. "It's them twisting it that ruins it for me," unquote. Well, that really got him in a lot of trouble, as you know. I've talked so far about the alleged surety that Americans seem to have about Jesus, some of the problems in their own texts and in the popular imagination with that surety. What can we say in our third chapter about what's going on in the discussion of Yeshua? The watershed is, to date it roughly, the year 1800, and the culprit is the science of history. Up until 1800, you really didn't have the science of history that Leopold von Ranke, the famous German historian, delineated in his famous line in a preface to a book that he wrote in 1825. He says, "History isn't about offering moral guidance to people. It's not about condemning the past. It's not about praising your own nation. It's simply about finding out, wie es eigentlich gewesen, what actually was going on, what actually happened. Let's get a picture of that. Let's use all of the sources, archaeological, philological, that we need to use and can use in order to find out exactly what Caesar Augustus did. Because in the Roman stories of Caesar Augustus, as in the Christian stories of Yeshua of Nazareth, within a generation, if not less, a prophet or a famous person becomes a hero, becomes mythologized. That certainly happened with Caesar Augustus. Just read Sallust's Lives of the Caesars. You know, there are all sorts of miracles, all sorts of wondrous events happening around these emperors that we doubt happened historically. They weren't eigentlich gewesen, what actually was the case, right? Could that also pertain to religion? Well, the introduction of a historical method in an effort to find out what actually happened tore the churches and continues to tear the churches and the culture today. There is a culture war going on, not just in the political and social order, but in the religious order as well, between the churches, within individual believers. A war between what one holds with conviction and has heard preached and has read in the gospel, and what actual scientific history has been able to unearth. People get very defensive because We don't want anybody criticizing our mother. She means too much to us. We don't want to know what her past life was like. We know what she means to us now and the existential significance of her love and her affection and the investment that we have in our mothers. So sometimes we would prefer not to have the historical truth. We'd rather live with the comforting world of our understanding convictions about a person, whether they cash out in actual reality or not. So the popularity of Yeshua and what he allegedly said and did, plus the personal investments that people have, their lives and its meaning connected with Yeshua of Nazareth, can easily and in general do override scientific historical information. But that's what we're going to try to undo in this class. No one will be quizzed, I certainly won't allow myself to be quizzed, about what each of us believes about Yeshua of Nazareth or doesn't believe. The only thing that we're interested in this class, not that that isn't important, but it's for another room, another part of the university, another part of your life. In this class, we're trying to be professional scientific historians, really. That's what this class is about. And if you actually came in order to be inspired by my preaching, I'll have to, you know, disavow that role because I'm no good at that and I wouldn't even attempt to try it. We're trying to be all of us here. And it's a legitimate thing that can coexist with our convictions about Yeshua. We're trying to simply find out what actually happened. We're trying to evolve a method. Let me just mention some elements of general elements of a method. We'll go into the particular parts in a moment, and when I go through the syllabus with you, I'll show you when we'll be talking about the specific methodological classes. Most of us, I mean, this is all of us, I think, live in what I call iconic worlds, worlds of symbols, worlds of significance, worlds that we're comfortable with. We don't call them iconic. Icons are images. No, they're not images. They're real to us. Let me draw that over here. Step one, we all come with a set of lived-in presuppositions, and we feel comfortable with them. But every once in a while, I tried to do it in the second paragraph or chapter of this lecture this evening, every once in a while we see cracks in that. Something doesn't work. It doesn't seem to fit. I tried to introduce some cracks by showing that we have limited the number of Gospels and that even if we stay within the number of Gospels we have major problems with reconciling them on major theological issues that Christians hold. That's one crack. This happens to us in our everyday life. We live inside of a paradigm, and every once in a while the paradigm doesn't work. A death in the family, a depression, something just doesn't happen, you lose your job, and you may wonder whether the world you were living in is the only world, the best world. You begin at that point to step outside that world and to realize that it is only a symbol system. You took it as the way things were, as if that were the natural order of things. But then when you find out that things aren't going well in your family, in your marriage, or whatever it is, you find out that that's not the natural order of things. It is one way of putting together the symbols, the meanings of your life, and it can change. Paradigms can shift. The second step, so I'm trying actually to apply this to our understanding of, say, the New Testament, the first century, the second step is to stand outside and begin to take the thing apart. What fits, what doesn't fit? The next moment is analytic. Ana in Greek and lytic, two words. Lytic means broken down. Ana is the word for down. It's broken up. Ana luein in Greek. You break things apart and you start to look at them in their individualities. And you begin to perform what we call a critique. Critique doesn't mean negative carping, wrong, wrong, wrong. No, that's not to critique something. In the philosophical sense of the term, a critique is knowing what the limits are of a phenomenon, what it can do inside of its limits, where its limits prevent it from doing something else. In other words, it's just sort of stepping back and recognizing something for what it is within its borders, rather than living inside of it and taking it for granted. This second step is what we're doing in this class. We're going to try to pull apart, not with any negative intention, at least not on my part, to pull apart what we know, to peel back what we know historically, archaeologically, philologically, then to peel back this text called the Christian Scriptures to find out how it got written. It didn't come right off the press, right? It took a long time to get formed. And the earliest gospel is at least 40 years after Yeshua had died, right? And there was no gospel was written by an eyewitness. Nobody had a tape recorder or a video camera. So what was the process whereby words got passed down, stories got passed down and elaborated until you finally have the result called the Gospel of Mark? That's what we're going to be doing in the second half of the, in this course, right? But that's the second moment of any method, really. And in scientific method, we have ways that we go about doing that. We raise questions, we gather data, we project a hypothesis, we test the hypothesis, we reform that hypothesis, it doesn't work, we test it again, until we get to the point where we make a judgment. Yeah, that paradigm, that hypothesis seems to explain the best I can at this time, with all the information from my colleagues, what we call a fact. It doesn't give you absolute truth. The nature of science is to be ever reformable as new data and better hypotheses, better judgments and tests take place, right? The word fact, in fact, comes from the Latin word factum, and factum means something that is constituted, something that is made or done by the interpreter. So a fact is a very fungible phenomenon. We sometimes think facts, that's hard stuff. No, that's data. That's real hard stuff. It's really difficult to change data. And if we catch you doing it, we throw you out of the lab, right? Data is data. But fact is the result of pulling apart things and then making a judgment. Once we enter into the realm of factum, that is to say, the reasonable judgment about what seems to have been the case, it's up to each of us who care to do it to then appropriate that and make a new synthesis. What the meaning of this was. Here you didn't own the meanings. They were given to you. You drank them in, as it were. You were suffused with them. Here you step back. It may feel alienating. It may feel, it may jar one, right? Pull things apart in order to arrive at a fact that we can then make a synthesis, set of facts that we can make a synthesis out of. The iconic world, the hermeneutical world, hermeneutics meaning pulling apart, interpreting, finding out who said it, why they said it, etc. And then the last word, the synthetic moment, I call the political, because you enter back into society. It isn't political in the sense of voting, right? But it's entering back into the social world that you once occupied in your naivete. You now enter back into it knowing what it's about. And you are responsible for the meanings. They are your product, not simply the rabbi's, the priest, your mother's product. That's the general overall view that we're going to, the method that we're going to take. I'd like to go through the syllabus with you, and then after we do that, take a 10-minute break and come back for more of this. The first page of the syllabus simply tells you the title of the course and a subtitle as well. The course is called Jesus the Christ, How Did Jesus of Nazareth, we'll now say Yeshua of Nazareth, who never claimed to be Christ or divine. There's a difference between Christ, that's a human being, specially chosen by God, divine, that's not a human being, right? That's a God. He who never claimed historically to be the Christ or divine, how did he become the Son of God? He became officially, as it were, and I mean that in a literal sense, officially the Son of God at the Council of Nicaea in 325 CE. Although lots of people before that believed, let's say unofficially, had not yet been made a doctrine, a dogma, that he was the Son of God. But how did that evolve? We'll focus only on the first century, what we know about, what we can find out about Yeshua and about the communities that succeeded him, who are the ones who declare him to be the Messiah and eventually divine. Let's look at the overview. And I may be reading things you already know. Who was he, this historical figure? We're making a distinction between the Yeshua of history and the Mashiach of faith, the Christos of faith. What did he actually say or do as contrasted with what early Christians, for example, Paul, writing in the 50s, the gospel writers, writing in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, believed that he said and did, open parentheses, not to mention what Bill O'Reilly thinks he said and did, and Jerry Falwell, or the Pope. What did the man, Yeshua, a Jewish peasant, but not a peasant in the sense of a farmer, he was more of a city technites, what they say in Greek, you know, he was some sort of manual laborer with a craft. What did Yeshua actually think of himself? What did he think his mission was? Now, you know what other people, or you yourself, think his mission was. Did he actually think that that was his mission? Well, you say, of course, it's in here in red. Well, we've pointed out that that's a problem. We'll soon see how that's a problem. What did he actually think of himself and his mission as contrasted with the messianic and even divine claims that the Christian scriptures make about him? That's the problem, the topic that we have. If you don't have that question, if you already know, then this course is a waste of time. You should get your money back if you've put it down any money, because this course is not for people who already know, which means usually are convinced believers. Yes, it's also for those people, but only if they want to ask these questions and entertain them as valid questions with us. In short, what are the differences and what are the continuities between the Yeshua who lived and died? The only period that we know of his life is between about 28 CE and 30 CE, 2 years. That's the only area that we have any historical information about him. The differences and continuities between what he said, thought, and did in those 2 years and what the first century and, of course, all the following centuries have made of them through faith. Here's the point. Over the last four decades, I said that the real turning point is 1800, but since World War II, historical scholarship on Yeshua and on his times. And it doesn't matter who conducts the historical scholarship, whether Jews or Christians or Muslims or non-believers, has arrived at a strong scientific consensus about what this undeniably historical figure said and did, how he presented himself and his message to his Jewish audience. Jesus had no intention of being a Christian, not even a Catholic. Often, that historical evidence about Jesus does not easily dovetail with the traditional doctrines of Christianity. What we have is an unhistorical orthodoxy, an orthodoxy that's not based on history, that's based on other things. How then might we adjudicate the conflicting claims? That has to come out in our topic as well. So this is a course about history, not about faith or theology. Not here to make you a believer. Not here to make you the village atheist either. We just want to find out what actually happened. The course will examine the best available literary and historical evidence, so literary referring to the Christian scriptures, historical referring to the whole panoply of evidence, about Yeshua and his times. We will also discuss methodologies for getting at that evidence and interpreting that evidence. And the goal is to help all of us make our own judgments and draw our own conclusions. Next page of the syllabus gives you required texts. Let me point out that it's slow a coming, not too slow though. There will be a website that you can tune into as registered students of continuing studies, and somehow we'll get that information to you by an email. You type in this URL, right, and you click on it, and the next thing you know, you're inside of a program that tells you about this course, what you're reading next time, and texts that are not buyable in the bookstore that you can download and read in class. Okay? There are plenty of texts to read, but there'll be a few more that I'm going to scan and put up there for you to read. It saves Xeroxing costs, saves trees, and so on. So I'm going to ask you to have these texts. The first is a certain edition of the Christian scriptures. Why this edition? Because it's one of the more updated, best translations, right? It's inexpensive. And why the same one? Why can't you read the King James? Certainly, have the King James by your bedside. But it's written for people in the 16th century and for scholars, mostly of the 20th century, who love to hear that language. But when I say, let's open up to page 95, you know, we'll all be on the same page, and it'll be the Epistle of James or something like that. So I'd ask you to get that. It costs about $6, I think. If you can get these cheap used, by all means do. Second book is one that I wrote that is available only on the internet now, because it's out of print, coming back into print. And the only place that asked me to put it up, I sort of blush when I notice the URL. It's called infidels.org. You know, I didn't choose that, please. But they said, can we put it up? And I said, why not? And they've done it. Paula Fredrickson, a wonderful scholar at Boston University, her book, From Jesus to Christ, in paper, all of these are in paperback, second edition, is going to be a main text that we'll use, along with Bernard Scott's Reimagine the World Concerning the Parables of Jesus, and Robert Miller's edited text, so it's got various authors in there, arguing over whether Jesus was apocalyptic or not. This is a hot topic in exegesis is the fancy word for scripture scholarship, right? So we'll sometimes just say exegesis, and that's a hot topic. Was Jesus apocalyptic or not? Did he expect the end of the world or no? Next, Dominic Crossan's very powerful book, Who Killed Jesus? You know, if you read the Christian New Testament, the Christian scriptures, Paul, and is himself a Jew, says the Jews killed Jesus. That's highly, highly inflammatory and historically doubtful. The Roman Empire killed Jesus. The accounts that we have about the passion and death of Yeshua are all theologized. They're not you are there with a camera. They're not what Mel Gibson pretended to show. They are theologizations. They've got a propaganda point to make, a faith point to make. And they're written by people who are angry at the Jewish communities for having expelled them because of their claims that Yeshua was the Mashiach. So they're filled with anti-Jewish sentiments. Right? You have the Jewish people calling upon themselves the blood of Yeshua, which is absolutely historically impossible. Right? Not to mention the centuries of persecution that the Jewish people have suffered because of that alleged sentence. There's another good example, isn't it? It's in the Bible. What can we say? The Bible doesn't like Jews. The New Testament doesn't like Jews. So it's not my fault, someone might say. It's, you know, it's Christianity that makes me do it. There's one good reason why we want to read these texts with an historical eye. I think Dominic Crossan, Who Killed Jesus, is one of the best books on the death of Yeshua. By the way, Dominic Crossan, who's a dear friend and a brilliant scholar, now retired, is going to be lecturing in San Jose on a Friday night and all day Saturday. I think there are four lectures. I think the whole cost of it is $30 for 1, 2, 3 lectures. I'm certainly going to pony up my $30. I wish I could take it out of your tuition and give it back to you so that you could hear Dominic, who's a wonderful, first of all, a lovely Irish speaker with wit and polish and excellent, excellent scholarship. I mean, he knows his languages. He's traveled through the Middle East. He's written more books than you can shake a stick at, and they're all excellent and have been well reviewed. He's going to be at a church down here in San Jose. I'll get you the information. It'll be on coursework, and I highly recommend that you attend that. Take a day off here and go there or something, but I would highly recommend you hear Dominic and meet him. And the last book listed is Stephen Patterson, Rethinking the Death and Life of Yeshua, of Jesus, a fine book. All of these in paperback, so they won't cost you, I hope, a ton of money. Go ahead, please. They are, indeed, yeah. I think maybe the New Testament is on its way. So, you know, use something meanwhile until you can get hold of this. But it's really a good translation. It's the New Revised Standard Translation. We'll look now at an overview of the course, and then we'll take our 10-minute break. Today's class, I'm trying to give them titles that'll keep me awake at my computer. So it's Call Me Yeshua, parallel to Call Me Ishmael in Moby Dick, right? It's simply an introduction to the course where we try to defamiliarize our understandings of Yeshua. We think that we've got it all together, but there's lots of cracks in that cosmos, and we want to let it crack so that we can get in, pull things out, and learn them better, put them back together again. The second week, next class, will be about the history of Israel leading up to Yeshua. So it's called Kingdom and Catastrophe, the catastrophe being 586 CE, BCE, before the Common Era, when the Kingdom of Jerusalem was destroyed, the Kingdom of Israel, Judah actually, was destroyed by the Babylonians. And everything changes in Judaism at that point, and we can find a continuity leading up to Second Temple Judaism and the context of Yeshua. So it's very important that we not treat Yeshua as if he lived in a fundamentalist theme park. Oh, here's where he was born. Oh, look at the diorama, how interesting. And this is what, no, we have to know the real historical context in which he lived, and that will enrich our understanding of his parables, of his deeds, of his death. The third week is called Left Behind, punning on that series of rapture books and movies too. Who was left behind after Yeshua died? Believers would say he died, but he came back and he lived on for another 40 days. Again, they're drawing on only two verses of Luke for the 40 days, and then ascended into heaven. Well, that may be mythologized history, not actual history. But those who were left behind are real historical figures. And Dominic Crossan's book, The Birth of Christianity, I highly recommend it to you, but it's too expensive to put on the reading list for you, talks about those dark years, dark only because there's no literary remains between the death of Yeshua in 30 and the first mention of Yeshua in any literature in the year 50 by Paul of Tarsus, right? That in-between period is the fruitful soup in which is mixed together what will become the gospel, the gospel of Paul, which is quite different from the gospels that appear in the four canonical gospels. So, left behind, who were those first Christians? The fourth one is where we get into the methodology of how do you pick up this book, which presents itself as, yes, gospel truth, and peel it back to find out how it got written and who's behind it. So I call that peeling the onion, going from the gospels at the end of the century back through Paul in the middle of the century, back to what we can discern about Yeshua in those 2 years of his so-called public life. The next meeting, Apocalypse Now, raises the question of whether or not Yeshua thought the world was going to end. And it deals with his baptism by John the Baptist, who was a modified apocalyptic figure, and how Jesus in turn modified John's apocalypse. So that one really, there's where we start to get into the life of the historical Yeshua, and we start with a problem and try to resolve it. We'll be reading that book called The Apocalyptic Jesus for that meeting. Words and wonders, obviously referring to his parables and his miracles, so-called. The ways of a prophet will walk through a day in the life of Yeshua as Mark presents it and as the other evangelists present it, and try to find out what he said and what he did and didn't do. We'll have to talk about the miracles. Did he really make water into wine? We all wish he did, but it seems that historically that's not the case, nor did he walk on water. None of the nature miracles where you transform material things have any historical basis as far as we know. But then what about the healing miracles? We'll talk about that in great detail. And then the last 4 weeks focus on how Yeshua moves from being a prophet to being an icon, a religious icon, and it's involved with his death and his resurrection. If he'd gone back to Galilee, kept his mouth more or less shut, the empire would not have struck back. He would have died in his bed, and what would have become of this movement that he inspired for some two and a half years? But the empire did strike back, and it killed him, and that was quite normal and typical for the time. So the first of these two discussions of the death of Yeshua will just deal with the historic elements of the death of Yeshua. The second one, crisis and continuity, will talk about how the communities that came after him turned that tragic, tortured death into a martyrdom, and then from a martyrdom into an inevitability. God had planned it from the beginning. Then from an inevitability into the salvation of all humankind, from Adam till the end of time. So we're going to find out that rich period there in the early century, the early decades, I meant to say, before Paul, when an execution became a martyrdom and inevitability and the salvation of the world. That's pretty interesting stuff. And then the last two deal with what is usually called the resurrection. The word doesn't exist in the New Testament. The first is called Apocalypse to Come, how the prophet got woken up. That's the word the New Testament uses, awakening. Awakening. That's also, by the way, the translation of the word Buddha, the awakened one. But then the awakening of the prophet in the earliest text becomes the resurrection. History gets rewritten, and then we're on the road to Yeshua becoming not only Messiah, but also divine. That's an overview of how the course is going to go. Let's take 10 minutes now. No more than 10, though, please. Okay? And we'll pick up again at 10 minutes after the hour.
I put on the board for this second hour just some abbreviations of three general topics that I would like to pick up that address concretely some of the issues that we talked about more abstractly a moment ago. The first set of issues revolves around the early life of Yeshua. So his conception, his birth, his family, Christmas, basically, in the Christian view of things. The second set of issues concerns these resurrection and ascension. And the last one concerns what I call the messianic moment. So let's see if we can make some sense of all of these things. I'll be referring to scriptural texts that you might want to jot down to have a look yourself. I'll be reading them from this Bible, which is called the Scofield Bible, which is the real buckle on the Bible belt. This is an edition that was put out around 1910 by a Mr. Scofield, which is the, it has all sorts of interpretative footnotes that are the basis for fundamentalism. So if you want to know what Jerry and Pat and other people are thinking and how they got those ideas, you just simply read through here. It'll give you all you need to know about the rapture, for example. Let's take, let's start with the early life of Yeshua. What do we know about his conception and his birth, and what are the sources? Again, I'm always presuming the word historically. What do we know? What do we know as history? The answer is very short. Nothing. There's no mention of when he was born. Some scholars have tried to date it in relation to Herod the Great and place his birth at about 6 to 6, the year 6 to the year 4 BCE. It's interesting that our chronological ordering of Western history begins only in the 6th century when the Christians, now in power, let us say, were tired of using the old chronological system of the pagan Romans. They had counted from the beginning of the city of Rome, ab urbe condita, from the city having been founded in 753 BCE. That abbreviation is AUC. So you counted that as the year one, and then you kept going. Well, they were tired of that. And a monk said, with papal permission, why don't we start to date things from the birth of Yeshua? Good. Except he had two problems. The West had not yet discovered the number zero. So they didn't know how to talk about the first year, if we could, the first hypothetical year of Yeshua's life. They started it as the year one, where it's actually building up to the year one. Year one only starts after 365 days of his birth, of him being alive. They didn't have the letter zero, and they got the date wrong in any case. And that's why we think that far from being born in the year one, and far from being born on December 25th, which was, of course, a Roman pagan festival that the Christians took over, as they did with so many of the pagan festivals, they dated that year one. It was probably 6 to 4 years too late for Yeshua's birth. We're fairly sure that among the dates of his possible death, April 9th of the year 30 of the Common Era is the more likely, the most likely one. But of his conception and birth, we know nothing. Now, there are two of the Gospels, Matthew and Luke, that tell stories about the conception and birth of Yeshua. And I emphasize stories, they're not history. For one thing, where did they get this information, since they come some 80 years after the event? In the Christian tradition, one used to say that the Blessed Virgin Mary told them, she would be the primary source, obviously. Well, I was there one day and an angel came in, and wasn't I surprised to find out that I was pregnant. Once I said yes, I was. Those stories, if they were told by Mary, were told very late in her life when she was going senile, because she told them two very different stories, Matthew's and Luke's, about the conception, about the promises, the birth, the visiting of her cousin Elizabeth. That's only in Luke. Whether there were wise men coming from afar, whether there were shepherds. What we call the Christmas story is a weaving together of those two very disparate theological mythologies, legends about the birth of Yeshua. They were following in a noble tradition of sacralizing the birth of sacred or important people. Pagans did it, Jewish people did it, Christians eventually did it. Right? It was a normal literary trope of the time. And what we call the Christmas story, when the Sheehan family, my own family, gets together at Christmas time, we always, you know, walk these wise men across and we mix up the stories the way most people do. But when we look at it from outside, we realize that these stories are unharmonizable. You can't put them together, and they are not historical at all. How he was conceived, how he was born, is not known and is not reported historically in any source at all. What about the three wise men, my favorite group of guys? I should make the sum of money reasonable. I'll give $15. I'll give $50. I'll stop there. To the person who can find the three wise men in the scriptures. Hold me to that. $50. Because they're not there. Wise men are there. Magoi, they're called in Greek. It means magoi, sort of seers, religious oracle types, right? And they come from afar, but it doesn't say they're three, so I've already won, you know, I've held on to my $50. They come, they go to Herod, the king, in Jerusalem, and they say, "Where is the anointed one, the Mashiach?" And Herod says, "What?" Because that meant another king, another, you know, sort of like a rival king. So he goes and he consults his priests and scribes, and they look it up, and like good Christians, it's right there, all these prophecies. It's at Bethlehem. So Herod tells them, "Bethlehem, but when you find him, come back and tell me so that I too can go and visit him," meaning so that I can have him assassinated. Well, it's a wonderful story. They go, and they find the Yeshua, not in a manger, by the way. That's the other story. That's Luke's. Matthew likes rich people. Luke likes poor people. Right? So the rich magoi show up, but how do we get three? What gifts do they give him? Do you remember from your childhood? Gold, frankincense, myrrh. Three gifts, three wise men. That's where the deduction comes from. There was a big fight in the 1960s among mainstream churches. I'm talking about Anglicans, Methodists, Presbyterians, Catholics, over whether the three wise men were historical or not. And there were swords drawn, metaphorically speaking, about this. People always around Christmas time, you'll always find in the magazine, even Nature, such a good magazine, "Well, there was, you know, a bursting star around that time." And that proves, of course, that the Magi followed. No, it doesn't. It means that maybe somebody heard about that, Matthew, and said, "Well, let's write that into the story. It really fits well." What does it matter? Matthew was there not to tell history. He was there to convince you that this was the Mashiach. And so, therefore, of course, there will be equally miraculous events as there would be about a famous rabbi or a famous pagan priest. Why not? Our guy is as good as them. Better, in fact. What about Yeshua's family, staying still with the early Yeshua? Well, he didn't have any siblings, as we know, because his mother was a virgin. The only problem is that the gospel says he did have siblings. He had four brothers and at least two sisters. You'll find that in Mark chapter 6, verse 3, I believe. You'll find it in Matthew chapter 13, verse 55. I'm very proud of myself to be able to rattle off those numbers. I'm not a Protestant, a Catholic. We never read the Bible. We don't know, you know, Mark 6, 3 from Matthew 13, but it's right up here. In any case, there they are mentioned. They're mentioned by name, the most famous being James. He was eventually the man who took over the Jerusalem church in Yeshua's name after Yeshua had died. It isn't Peter, it's James. He kind of turned it into a family concession, a family franchise in a certain sense. Right? James was then killed sometime probably in the 40s or 50s. I should know the date and I don't. His brother Judas, his other brother Simon, his other brother Joseph, which is close to Joseph, you know, which may have been the father of Yeshua, plus the plural sisters. Of course, they don't name them, being a culture that was masculinist in its orientation, it didn't think it important enough to name those brothers and sisters. What do you do when you have the gospel themselves saying that he had brothers and sisters, and the traditional mainstream churches maintaining that Mary is a virgin? You got a problem. But no problem. We just, you know, we try to put that together. Here's the way we do it. We find out there were two solutions. There's actually three solutions. The third solution, which is the one that is historically the most probable. All history is a question of probability, right? The best probability is that his mother was not a virgin and that he did have those other siblings. So Epiphanius, a Christian priest writing in the year 382, Epiphanius said, oh, it's easy. Joseph had had another wife. They had children. Then in his old age, he married the Virgin Mary and found her pregnant by God. No problem. So we've solved that one, right? Or there's an even better way to solve it. And that was done by Jerome 1 year later. He wasn't satisfied with that. Jerome was a great philologist. He knew his Hebrew, his Greek, his Latin. And he said, well, really, the word for in the gospel for brothers and sisters is adelphoi in Greek. Adelphoi, if they're masculine, and adelphi, if they're sisters. You know the word philadelphia, brotherly love, the city of brotherly love. So adelphoi, adelphi means brothers and sisters. But Jerome couldn't handle that, so he went searching through every Greek text he could find and found at least one instance where it was used to mean cousins. Solved. Mary is still a virgin, and these were really adelphoi, that is to say, cousin. The way you'll see people on campus, my sons will sort of embrace their roommates and say, yo, bro, how you doing? Bro, he's not his brother, he's his dear and good friend. So maybe adelphoi, adelphi could mean cousins, male and female. But you can see what's going on there. Doctrine, dogma, orthodoxy is putting pressure on history and finally crushing history. No, the real solution, the one that came up was brought up by Helvidius, is that no, they were his blood brothers and sisters, and you'll have to go figure about Mary as a virgin. And both Catholic and Protestant scholars, in a book that they put together as an ecumenical effort called Mary in the New Testament, have said, quote, that there are no plausible reasons, no historical reasons in the New Testament. So I'm not really quoting, so I'll take that quote off. No plausible historical reasons for thinking that these were anything but blood brothers and sisters born presumably of Miriam, the mother of Jesus. Her name was Miriam. So those are three areas that deal with the early life of Yeshua, about which we know nothing. A footnote on his family, however, nowadays, especially in mainstream churches, more than in, let us say, evangelical churches, Mary is, certainly in the Catholic tradition, she's more than Jesus. You know, we could put Jesus on the shelf and Mary would do just fine for us Catholics. But, as a matter of fact, when you read that chapter in Mark, chapter 6, his family thinks that Yeshua's crazy. What's he doing, acting like this? So they come, the brothers come, and the mother, to drag him home. In other words, he's gone off his rocker. And when people come to Yeshua, who's preaching to a crowd, according to Mark 6, and they say, Yeshua, your mother and your brothers and sisters are outside. He says, these are my brothers and sister. These are my mother and father. So he is actually separating himself from his family. Jesus was not a family values guy. Somebody would say, let the dead bury their own dead fathers. come follow me, I'm the one who counts here, is not exactly a family values guy, a la Jerry Falwell. Somebody who is reported to have been said in the scriptures to say, I've come to bring a sword to divide father from son and families from each other, is not a family values guy. So again, we have a bit of a disjunct between even the Christian scriptures themselves, if we take them as authoritative, and what the non-historical orthodox position is about Yeshua. So much for his early life, if you will. Let's go to the big time stuff. His death, his resurrection, and his ascension. So we'll be talking about those at some length. I'll just start with the ascension. I pointed out to you earlier that it's not mentioned at the end of three Gospels. Mark, by the way, has such a bitter, dark ending to his Gospel that someone rewrote the ending or added a new ending to Mark. So there's two endings to Mark's Gospel. They're both printed in the New Testament in the Christian scriptures. At the end of his first Gospel, women go to the tomb to find Yeshua, and they don't find anything. And then they see an angel in there. That's a character right out of central casting in Jewish mythology, right? It means God is speaking to you. God is giving a message to you. But since God can't come down in person, he always sends an angel. So an angel is a stand-in for a message from God. And the angel says, why are you looking for the living among the dead? He's not here. See the place where they laid him. Go and tell his disciples that he's gone before you to Galilee. There you will see him. Next verse of the gospel, last verse of the gospel. They fled and said nothing to no one because they were afraid. Nothing to no one. They use a double negative. Udeni uden epon. To nobody did they say nothing. That's the first gospel. No wonder they don't use that one on Easter Sunday morning in Christian churches, right? How would they get the word out that he was resurrected if these women, the first and only witnesses, said nothing? So some years later, when the Gospels of Matthew and Luke had said, we can't end that way. We better have some appearances. We better have them showing up, eating food, according to Luke ascending to heaven. Someone then wrote an extra ending to Mark, and it starts all over again. First hours of the first day of the week, people come to the tomb, and instead of running in fear, they go and tell the disciple, and so on. So even within the Gospels, you've got these contradictions about this most important moment. Anybody could be a prophet and be killed. But was he awakened from the dead? Did he ascend into heaven? These are the important theological or faith issues where we have this crack in the non-historical orthodoxy. So it's not mentioned in Mark or in Matthew or in John. Yeshua is still on earth at the end of Matthew's and John's gospel. As I pointed out, it's mentioned twice by Luke, but with different dates. Whether it's Luke 25, the resurrection chapter where Yeshua ascends into heaven that night, or whether it's the first verses of the Acts of the Apostles, please.
You mentioned the two different endings to, I believe it was Mark. Are they in different versions of the Bible?
No. The question is, these two different endings of Mark, the real ending and the added-on ending, are they in different versions of the Bible? No. They're just actually glued together at the end of Mark's Gospel. So chapter 16, verses 1 to 8 is the way he ended it. And then the rest of that Gospel, which goes on for some more verses, are the ones added on by an anonymous editor. Mark 2 is anonymous, but an extra anonymous editor. Thank you for asking that question. Let's go to the issue of the ascension. As I say, it's not only not mentioned in three out of the four Gospels, not only is the date of it dubious, because Luke, the same author, gives two different dates. Does that mean that he didn't intend it to be taken as an historical event, do you think? That he meant it as a theological legend about Yeshua, so that we get the point that faith says that Yeshua isn't dead, he's with God. We've got to get him there somehow, so let's have him ascend from Bethany. But for those who think, no, this must be literal, stop and think of how easy it is to be ascended into heaven in the Hebrew, first century Hebrew cosmos, and how difficult it is to be ascended into heaven from the 21st century planet Earth that we know. In the Hebrew cosmos, the Jewish people knew better, but they often used an ancient framework. They knew about Ptolemaic astronomy, of course, the educated did. But nonetheless, they depicted the world as, in effect, a bowl turned over on a flat plate. The flat plate is the flat earth, and the bowl would describe the heavens that we see from east, west, to north, and south, with the stars embedded, the fixed stars embedded in that firmament, that vault, right? On the other side of which there was water, and that would drip down, and that would be called rain. And on the other side of the water was God, Yahweh, in his heaven. So it's really quite simple to simply climb a mountain, say a few words to your disciples, and then, by divine power, be lifted up, and in a matter of minutes, hour maybe, most, to be in heaven. That's easy if you live in the mythological cosmology of 1st century CE, Second Temple Judaism. If, however, Yeshua ascended into heaven in our cosmos today, in which we are but one galaxy of about 200 billion galaxies, rough estimate, each of which has about 100 to 200 billion stars, we don't know how many planets are circling around those. Up until 1930, we thought we were the only galaxy, officially. But with Hubble, we find out the universe is expanding and there's jillions more galaxies out there. Let's put him on the Mount of Bethany, which is still there, and have him ascend into heaven at the speed of light. Not just, you know, first century elevation. Speed of light, 86,000 miles a second? 186,000 miles a second. He's gone. He's in a rush. He'd still be inside the Milky Way galaxy. He would not even have gotten beyond the Milky Way. Again, if you want to take it literally, I think what you end up doing is making the scriptures ridiculous. It's different to take them seriously and read them the way they were meant to be read, that is to say, with imagination, with insight, with an understanding that these are faith documents, not histories. That's taking them seriously, and something else follows from that. Or to take them literally, and to say with Jerry Falwell that there's not one error in the whole scriptures. Errors of geography, not. Errors of science, not, etc., etc. Then you get yourself caught in a box, I think, and you end up making both yourself and the scriptures themselves ridiculous. Let's go to another example under R and A, the resurrection itself. Some people think that after Yeshua died, let's use the traditional time and date, 3 p.m. in the afternoon, a Friday afternoon just before Sabbath, when Sabbath was also Passover, so a very doubly whammy day, an important day, roughly on the day 7th of April, what we would call 7th of April of the year 30 CE, Common Era. That's the end of his life. That's the end of his history. However, as we'll see in the last four sections of our meetings of our course, when you believe something that someone says, you often end up legendizing and mythologizing that person's life and afterlife. The traditions of the time expected some sort of, some people expected in Second Temple Judaism, not all, a resurrection of the dead at the end of time. That was a very late arriving notion in Second Temple Judaism. The first time it appears is in the book of Daniel, written about 165 BCE, during the persecution of the Jewish people by the Seleucids. Okay. It's a very late idea that people will rise from the dead. After Yeshua's death, and the trick is to find out when and how, his believers applied to him the notion of resurrection. But they didn't apply the literalist notions of resurrection that you get in the Gospels. We're talking about the years right after his death, as contrasted with the Gospels, where you've got a whole movie cast of angels and meetings in upper rooms and appearances and showing wounds in his side. That's much, much, much later. Soon after, they apply the resurrection notion to Yeshua without having him return to earth. He goes straight to heaven. The resurrection, the awakening of Yeshua, therefore took place at 3 p.m. on Friday afternoon, April 7th, 30 CE, in the minds of, as we reconstruct them, of his earliest believers. The mythologies come later. However, such a resurrection was considered to be a forecast of the end of the world. If anybody's getting resurrected, the general resurrection of us all, the crash and burn scenario that's predicted in Jeremiah and in Ezekiel and in Daniel, is going to come to pass. So they apocalyptized, they crash and burn-ized the awakening of Yeshua, which took place secretly, nobody seeing it. And in Matthew's gospel, interestingly, and the chapter is 27:51, if you've got it. I love this one. Let me read it out to you. This is written around 85 CE, so that's 55 years after the death of Yeshua. Lots of things happen in literature between those two. So here's the death of Yeshua, and here's what happens according to Matthew. And then Jesus cried out with a loud voice and gave up his spirit. Here's Matthew. And my goodness, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Did that actually happen? Or is that a Jewish Christian saying the Hebrew covenant is over? The Holy of Holies, which was closed off to us all, only the high priest could go in there once a year, Rosh Hashanah, right, is now torn, and now the sacred is among us all. Or do we have some historical record? How would he know? He's writing 55 years later. That you couldn't Google or Wikipedia this information. It's invented by Matthew to make a theological point about the death of Yeshua. Not only that, but an apocalyptic point. And then the earth quaked and rocks were split open, just as apocalyptic preachers said would occur at the end of time. So the death of Yeshua, which is awakening into heaven, right, is apocalyptically an earthquake. That means soon all of us are going to go in, like the saints marching in. The end of the world is soon to come. So neither of these are historical events. You say, well, how do we know that? Let's follow on. And after the rocks were split, Friday afternoon, April 7th, graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints that slept were awakened. The saints means the holy ones. So those Jews, for example, who had given their lives as martyrs under the Seleucid persecution just a century and a half earlier, they, or other holy ones in Jerusalem, are resurrected at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday, Good Friday. And Yeshua is still dead. His resurrection, according to Matthew, takes place Sunday morning. Let's read on. And after his resurrection, so that's how many hours? 2.5 days. They came out of their graves and went into the holy city and appeared to many. So try and imagine this scenario here. If we take it literally, you've got these people being awakened by an earthquake, a God-mandated earthquake. Their tombs are cracked open, but they don't go out. Out of respect for Yeshua, they're going to wait for 3 days till he resurrects from his tomb. So they're there, presumably shivering, right? Because it's got to be pretty cold in April in the highlands of Palestine in those days, right? Nothing to eat, nothing to drink, right? But then when somebody finally gives the signal, he's out! Yeshua has come out of his tomb, then they say, let's go and visit the relatives. So there's the relatives, you know, it's just after Passover, you know, people are sitting around watching television, and somebody walks in. It's Uncle Herbie. We thought he was dead. We've already divided up all of his stuff. He wants his house back. He wants his stuff back. If we take these things literally and spell out the literalism, it becomes ridiculous. That is to say, it makes us laugh. But they're not meant to be taken literally. You're supposed to know what the apocalyptic cosmos was that Matthew lived in. You're supposed to know, oh, this is a signal to me of what it really means that Yeshua died. It's not over. We couldn't have seen it all happen. But let's tell ourselves myths and legends that will bring to mind what it means. I think we're the only ones who are dumb enough to take it literally. I don't think that the original writers of their communities were that stupid. Let's go to a third point, what I call the messianic moment. Messiah, Mashiach, in Hebrew, comes from a verb which means to pour oil over someone's head, to anoint them with oil as a sign of God's blessing on them. So you can do that to a king, you can do that to a prophet, you might even sometimes do it to a priest. It's putting oil on them. In Greek, that's krein, that's where we get the word chrism. In the Christian baptism ceremony, oil is put on the child of the on the forehead of the child, forehead of the person who's going to be baptized. It's a continuation of the Jewish tradition of anointing, which is to say, you are a blessed one. And then the word Mashiach, which originally meant the king who was expected to take over again once we got rid of the Romans, becomes a spiritual Messiah, God's anointed holy one, more than just a king. Now he's God's saving figure, God's saving presence. And it becomes popularized in the Jewish Christian communities in the Greek word Christos, which means anointed, and then that is applied to Yeshua. Yeshua is the Mashiach, the anointed one. Again, this is something that is applied to him only by those who believe that he is the Mashiach, not by others. But when did he become God's anointed? Let's draw some timelines up here. First, I'm going to draw a timeline depicting the life of Yeshua from about, let's say, 5 BCE to his death in 30 CE. So we have his birth, we've got his baptism, we've got his death, and, if you care to historicize it, his resurrection. Following that, you've got the Christian authors, Paul in the 50s of the first century. You've got Mark around the year 70. That's the important deadline, isn't it? Because that's the destruction of the city and the temple of Jerusalem by Titus. Right? Then you've got the Gospels of Matthew and Mark. So put Matthew and Luke, I beg your pardon. And finally, by the end of the century, you've got the Gospel of John. So I've got two lines here. When did Yeshua become the Mashiach? As far as we can tell historically, Yeshua never thought he was the Mashiach. There is no historical evidence in the scriptures that he ever claimed to be the Messiah. When those claims appear in the scripture, they're written in by communities afterwards. I'm saying that, as it were, dogmatically. We have to work out how one comes to say that. But there's no scripture scholar worth her salt today, Christian, Jewish, non-believer, who would claim that Yeshua ever thought that he was the anointed of God. He thought he was a prophet, but not the anointed of God. So when does he become, according to the writers, the communities, when does he become the Messiah? Paul, the very first texts that we have, and they cover from around 50 to 58 CE, Paul says that he never was the Messiah during his lifetime. That's why Paul never tells you anything that Yeshua did. He never tells you about a miracle. He never tells you about a parable. Because for him, Yeshua became the Messiah. God chose him only after he had died. When God miraculously and invisibly awakened him and took him to God's own right hand, that was the event of making him the Messiah. So we'll call that the messianic moment. It's after his life. Prior to that, he was a very interesting, charismatic, faithful, observant, edgy, Jewish holy man. Only after his death, according to Paul, does he become the Messiah. The Epistle to the Romans, chapter 1, verse 4, will tell you that, among other places. By the time you get to Mark in 70 AD, he wants to tell us something about the life of Yeshua, his words, his parables, and his deeds. So he can't accept that Yeshua was a nobody, just a holy man. He wants to say that when Yeshua began his public life at his baptism in the River Jordan, by John the Dunker. That's what baptizer means, someone who dunks. Baptizein means to dunk someone into the water. By John the Baptizer, that's when he became the Messiah. But nobody knew it except him, says Mark. Yeshua comes out of the River Jordan. The skies open only for him. He's the only one who could see it and hear the voice. This is my beloved son. That means my Messiah, my anointed one. Hear him. Right. And then, as he performs miracles, they are messianic miracles all through. So Mark has taken the messianic moment and brought it back to this point. So he was Messiah during his lifetime, not just when he was taken up into heaven. Matthew and Luke, remember, these are the two who have nativity legends in their first two chapters or so. Mark goes right up to the age of 12 with Yeshua and has a legend of him teaching the teachers in the temple to show how wise he was. They say that's not enough. He was Messiah from the get-go. Notice Messiah does not mean divine. It means you're an ordinary human being with God's anointing upon you. So it's nothing about divinity. Make that distinction, please, between Mashiach and God. So they invent stories of an angel coming down and telling Mary that the child that will be conceived by God in her womb is Messiah from the moment of conception. Notice, they're not saying that he was the incarnation of God. They're just saying this normally, well, not normally conceived, but this little zygote in the uterus is already Messiah. And that's why, in Luke's legend, when Mary goes to, Mary, who's 3 months pregnant, goes to visit Elizabeth, her cousin, who is 6 months pregnant, the baby in Elizabeth's womb, John the Baptist, leaps for joy. Like that. Right? Because he's in the presence of the Messiah. And these little fetuses know that, I guess. By the way, why did, pardon?
What does the word prophet mean?
Prophetes means someone who speaks for God in front of the people.
As opposed to Messiah.
A prophet can be the Messiah if he gets the anointing. Otherwise, he's just a prophet. Mm-hmm. But a prophet who's been anointed, it could have been a priest as well, who's anointed, that would mean God is going to work through that Messiah to undo the pagan domination of Israel. That's what a Messiah was good for. He wasn't a holy guy. He was a guy with an M16 and cruise missiles. He was going to get rid of the Romans. Right? So it could have been a priest, it could have been a prophet, it could have been a military figure, as in 135 CE, a rabbi declared Bar Kokhba to be the Messiah. Right? So anybody, presumably not women, we don't allow that, but any male, ordinary male, military male, political, prophetic, or priest, could become that anointed one, whose role was really to restore the kingdom. The Christians then turn that into, well, no, it's salvation in a spiritual sense rather than restoration of the kingdom. Why, by the way, if I can just footnote that that visit of the pregnant Mary to the pregnant, more pregnant Elizabeth, why doesn't Luke invent the story of John the Baptist as qua fetus jumping in the womb in joy at the presence of Yeshua? Yeshua was a Jewish young man who heard about this crazy preacher down in the Jordan. He's up in the north, and he hears about him down in the south. He goes down there and puts himself under the tutelage of John the Baptist. He becomes a disciple of John the Baptist. In fact, he works for John the Baptist in his early period, as we'll see. Now, for a Christian, that sounds like it's backwards. He shouldn't be working for John the Baptist. John the Baptist should be working for him. Therefore, the Christian invention of John the Baptist saying, I'm not the guy, I'm not the man, there's someone greater coming after me, I'm not even worthy to untie and tie his sandals, he's so important. And there he is, behold, the Lamb of God. So it's Christians rewriting history to put their man on top. And Luke says, since he's Messiah from the get-go, let's make sure that John the Baptist knows that interuteranely, so they have him leap in his womb. I mean, it's very interesting and clever when you see what they're doing. Okay, we've got three different messianic moments. Either he was a Messiah from birth, from conception. In fact, there are all sorts of non-canonical gospels of the childhood of Jesus, which I just love, because they're filled with all the fantasies that I had as a child. Right? Jesus is sort of bored, you know, hanging around, being, you know, Messiah is sort of boring until you can sort of do it. He takes some clay, shapes it into a nice dove, blows on it, and it flies away. But the one I really like is some kid comes along, some nasty little bugger, you know, and he boggers Yeshua and throws sand in his face and just goes, zap! And that kid's dead. So, every child's fantasy. Undo the bully who put sand in there. But you can see how these stories came up building on the canonical gospels. He's Messiah from the get-go. Why should we be surprised that he's sitting in the temple instructing all the PhDs in theology when he's only 12 years old? Imagine that. You know, Luke says that, and his parents come back and say, what is going on? He said, didn't you realize I have to be about my father's business? I'm the Messiah, after all. You know, just because these guys have doctorates and are, you know, high priests, I'm the Messiah. In any case, John, the last gospel, you notice how the evaluation is increasing of Yeshua as we go on. John says, why don't we take it to the max? Not only was he the Messiah, no, he wasn't even the Messiah, he was God. Here's the first time you get that story. Right. Some 70 years after Yeshua's death, and it doesn't take all over the Christian communities, some communities believe this, he was God from all time. And therefore, for the first time, you get incarnation. He actually came down as divine, took on human flesh. John never says anything about the conception or birth. He starts right off with the baptism, right? But the presumption is that he was God all along, and he even declared himself to be God. Before Abraham existed, I am. The words of Exodus 3:13, God says, I am. You know, I don't have a past or a present or future. I'm just always. But that comes only at the end of the century. So you can see the adjustment of the messianic moment and finally explosion of the messianic moment into the divinizing moment in the Gospel of John. And of course, as we'll try to show historically and by all the means at our disposal, Yeshua, who is an extraordinarily charismatic figure by all accounts, had no idea of himself as the Mashiach, much less as the divine Son of God from all eternity. But by saying that, by saying all of these things, we're pointing to a conflict between history and dogma, history and orthodoxy, history and faith, two different ways of approaching Yeshua, perhaps reconcilable, but that's that third moment of our method. After we pull things apart, we will see how one might reconcile or how you will reconcile them. As Mircea Eliade, the now deceased professor of the history of religions at the University of Chicago, pointed out that it is in the nature of these charismatic figures to be turned into heroes within a generation. Even in the Balkans in the 19th and 20th century, he traced that, where an outlaw fighting the Ottoman Empire becomes all of a sudden a saint, a holy man after his death in the eyes of the people. Right? So Yeshua, likewise, by this process that we're going to study, and we have to understand these groups before we go back and understand what they made of Yeshua, he himself becomes not only hero, not only divine, not only a salvific hero, but divine hero. But as soon as we draw this line between history and orthodoxy, what I'll call history and non-historical orthodoxy, orthodoxy that refuses to acknowledge historical scholarship, we are in what we could call the culture wars. Culture wars are not just about ethics, they're not just about gays and lesbians and all of those things. There are culture wars within the churches, right, between the churches, fundamentalist versus so-called mainstream, and within, presumably, the minds of believers themselves, right, a cognitive dissonance. Again, if the watershed is the 1800s, where have the churches been over these 200 and some odd years in terms of getting the message out to people? It seems that they would rather cover over the culture war that other people like Bill O'Reilly, who just yesterday published a book called, I haven't read it, I won't read it, called Culture Warrior. you know, in which he takes on all of the hot-button issues, because he knows, presumably, if he ever touches upon religion, what Jesus said and did and would say and would do. Or Ann Coulter's book, Godless, The Church of Liberalism, you know. She herself, who I guess proclaims herself a Christian, knows what the orthodox way of acting on all sorts of ethical, political, social issues in the name of Yeshua. But we're trying to find out, as I say, with von Branca, is what really happened. There is a resistance, I think we can agree, there's a resistance on the part of the official churches to take this seriously and draw the consequences. Either the ministers and priests who get up in the pulpit on Sunday morning and on Easter Sunday morning, either they know what their own scholars, their own believing scholars, Methodists, Presbyterians, Catholics, Anglicans, are saying, and they're not telling their communities for fear that the people will get up and leave. I maintain they're getting up and leaving because they don't tell them what the real story is. They can't take the mythologies anymore. They don't have any other explanation, so they walk. Or they don't know this scholarship themselves, which is also possible, in fact, very possible, in which case they're practicing without a license. But either way, I think the church is refusing to come to grips with the real earthquake that's going on, you know, down in the architectonic plates. It doesn't have to do with gay marriage. It doesn't have to do with who gets to be a priest or, you know, all of that stuff. It has to do with the bedrock doctrines on which they build all of their social and economic and political orders. And that's what we're investigating. And we're not, you know, we're not defending, we're not being defensive, we're just trying to find out what really happened, and we'll let the chips fall where they may. Let me just mention one last principle of organization here, and then I'll let you go. As soon as we realize, we'll go into this further later, as soon as we realize what language, how language is essential to human beings and how it works, and I'm going to be very brief in that regard, we can begin to understand why there is this culture war within the churches themselves, within the mind of the believers. There is a distinction between the subject of the sentence and the predicate of the sentence. We usually don't make that distinction. We think things come with their meanings attached to them. The meanings are natural to them. But of course they're not. Who puts the predicate Christ on the subject Yeshua? Who puts the predicate president on the current holder of the office? People of Florida? Supreme Court? I don't know. I mean, but what you've got is a community. You've got a community of people who apply this predicate there. And this community operates with a very complex set of interests, existential interests. What is the meaning of life? Good. Ethically and religiously good people saw and heard everything that Yeshua said and did, and they didn't think he was the Mashiach. Presumably, his closest follower, Peter, died around 64 CE before they ever got around to declaring Jesus God. So not even Peter could be Pope today because he didn't think Jesus was God. For that matter, Jesus couldn't be Pope today because he didn't think he was God. Once we recognize that you've got a linguistic community, in the broadest sense of linguistic, a cultural community with a set of interpretative energies and reasons for doing things, that's what we're going to try to find out, then you realize that the meaning of Yeshua does change. The significance, the importance might stay the same. But some people are going to say prophet, some people are going to say nice guy, some people are going to say pain in the neck. There are going to be different interpretations of him, and only by climbing into these worlds will we get an idea of not the result, but the process that led to the result. And that's what we'd like to, as far as I can see. There will be resistance to all of that. There are impersonal investments, the meaning of one's life. Right? Let's not check out certain things. There's going to be institutional investments, institutional ignorance, and institutional resistance to letting out the word. But we'll just leave those people to themselves and try ourselves to be, the best we can, historical scholars who simply take the data, try to analyze it, and see what we come up with. For next class, I'm not sure if it's on the syllabus or not, I'll ask you to read three things, one of which will appear on the the website. Do you have a listing on the first page there of what to read for next time, or the second page? Okay. Of those two, Fredrickson, read everything up to page 77, so the preface, you know, and all those Roman numerals. In my own book, which is available on the web, I think the listing is given there, I'd ask you to read the first 25 pages or so, pages 3 to 28. And importantly, a book that we've put up there so that you can read just bits and pieces of it, Graba's book on the history of Israel, which gives you a quick overview of how we got from 0 to 60 miles an hour up to the time of Yeshua. That will open the doors for us to take up next time what I call Kingdom and Catastrophe, a History of Israel. Thank you very much.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.